Hey everybody, it's Glenn Thrush with Politico's Off Message Podcast. I'm coming to you after what I'd say is probably the best week in Hillary Rodham's political life. She won all five primaries on Stupor Tuesday. I guess it's called Stupor Tuesday. Some people are calling it Super Tuesday 3, the day before Wednesday. I don't know what the hell to call it. But the bottom line here is Hillary Rodham Clinton is probably going to be the first female nominee of a major party. I think this, it's not written in stone, but I would say it is written in brick. We've got Bernie Sanders would have to win something. Nate Cohn of the Times did an excellent analysis. You guys should look at it. 58% of the remaining delegates Bernie Sanders would have to win. That's a possibility, I would say, is an extraordinarily high unlikelihood. She now leads by 300 pledged delegates and a ton of superdelegates. I don't think it's going to happen for Bernie. And I can tell you now that a lot of Bernie folks I've talked with concede that point off the record, and the Clinton people are certainly starting to pivot to the general election. So what happened? I think what happened was Donald Trump invaded the Democratic primary. The same thing that happened a couple of weeks ago on the Republican side, where every Republican in the country who wasn't supporting Donald Trump realized this guy was going to be the nominee and freaked out. I think that started to happen with Democrats. I went up to New York and did a panel discussion, a really good one with Howard Dean and Ed Rollins. And we got, I think, 12 questions, and 10 of them were little old ladies freaking out about Donald Trump being the Republican nominee. And trust me, these were not Republicans. These were Democrats. Well, I think a version of that happened with the voters in all five of these states. Illinois and Missouri in particular were favored to kind of lean towards Sanders, fairly big college populations, white working class populations that seemed to sort of be in Sanders' corner. They did not go for him. In fact, if you looked at the exit polls coming out of Tuesday, something like, I think the range in the five states was 58% to 67%, showing that Democratic voters thought Hillary would be a better candidate against Donald Trump. And by the way, that defies logic. The polls actually say on a fairly consistent basis that Sanders does better in head-to-head matchups with Trump. But I think in their guts, Democratic voters went with the establishment on Tuesday and decided that Hillary Rodham Clinton was going to be the person who was best able to take on Trump. We'll see if that's true. Okay, so we are now, as she moves forward, and there's still some race left to run for Bernie Sanders, but I think we are on the precipice of something historic, and we really ought to recognize it. It's amazing to me during this campaign, we have not talked a whole hell of a lot about her being the first woman a presidential candidate from a major party. It is a major historic achievement, and that's why I wanted to speak with this week's guest, Jill Abramson, who was the first female executive editor of the New York Times, left under really tough circumstances a couple of years ago. And my former colleague Maggie Haberman and I did a big story just before the race began in 2015, before the candidates had sorted out, talking about Hillary's terrible relationship with the press. And a really central feature of that story was Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton's belief that the New York Times, specifically the New York Times under Jill Abramson, was out to get Hillary. Well, that's what made this discussion with Jill Abramson so fascinating. In the course of it, I asked her point blank, does she feel more sympathy for Hillary now having gone through what she went through in terms of being ousted at the Times? And she said flatly, yes. She also cast some question on the ultimate resolution of the email scandal that the New York Times, Hillary Clinton's homebrew email server story that the Times has broken. She thinks it's obviously a story worth covering, but she thinks it's been overhyped and that it will probably ultimately lead to not very much. And more importantly than that, she talked about the role of Hillary Clinton as a gender pioneer and her belief that the media, and she didn't call out her old paper per se on this, but she believes that Hillary Rodham Clinton has endured a greater amount of scrutiny than a comparable male candidate. I got to tell you, I mentioned some of these comments to people in Clinton land, and they were surprised, to say the least. But to me, the most surprising revelation, I didn't know this, I don't think it's been talked about very much, Jill Abramson, as a 22, 23-year-old kid right out of Harvard, worked for Bill Clinton. She, think about this, the executive editor of the New York Times, worked for a regional PR firm for Democratic candidates in the South, and found herself in I think it was 1980, sitting across a table from Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton talking strategy in the gubernatorial race. That and a bunch of other fascinating stuff coming up. As usual, a little bit of business. Please follow us on iTunes and rate us. I've been getting a ton of suggestions from you guys on potential guests. A lot of them I really like. One person came up with a brilliant idea, which we're going to pursue. I don't know if we're going to be able to secure it, of having a debate between Paul Krugman and Robert Reich on the podcast. I think that would be awesome. But we're getting a lot of really, really good feedback, and you can send anything to me at gthrush@politico.com. Well, without further ado, here's Jill Abramson. Tell me about one of the interesting aspects of your biography is that you once worked for this guy, Henry Howell. Tell me who he was and why he was significant.
He was a populist Democratic candidate making his third attempt to become governor of Virginia. He'd been lieutenant governor, and you know, his campaign slogan was "Keep the big boys honest."
And this is what time frame are we talking about?
It was 77.
So this is a couple of years after you were out of school.
Just like 1 year, after I was out of school. And you know, he was very, very liberal.
The quote that I remember was him talking, because he challenged the Byrd machine in Virginia. And the quote that I remember through the haze of the many years was, the Democratic Party can't have two right wings, can't fly if it has two right wings, right?
That sounds right.
Yep.
And the reason that I went to work for him is that I became consumed by politics and political journalism in my last years of college. I graduated in the Stone Age of 1976 and was, you know, just so interested in the rise of Jimmy Carter in the South.
And the New South.
He
was the first real New South wave, right?
And, you know, he very much fit the bill of the book, The Transformation of Southern Politics by Jack Bass.
Yep.
And you know, this all fascinated me. And I thought, you know, I'm not going to get a job right out of college covering a presidential election. So maybe it would be really interesting to see Southern politics from the inside. So that was, you know, one of my first jobs out of college.
And did that message, because it sounds, you know, obviously I'm asking you about this because he seems superficially at least to resemble a current presidential candidate. I mean, were you really, you later became like a campaign, you studied sort of campaign finance and you did investigative stories.
Right, I did become a political journalist.
Right, so was his focus on those sort of things? Obviously, he was an anti-segregationist, which was a big component of what he was about. But like, did that appeal to you? Is that what appealed to you about him?
I mean, his civil rights record definitely appealed to me, and the fact that he went against, you know, the conservative mainstream of both the Democratic Party and the state, and certainly the Republican Party then. And it was fascinating to see a campaign from the inside. I was the deputy press secretary, and so I was dealing with reporters, so I got to learn about how...
Your first interaction with real live reporters was on the other end?
No, because I'd been a stringer for Time magazine
right,
while I was in college.
Right.
And actually, it was the bureau chief at Time, Jim Bell, who'd been the Atlanta bureau chief,
right,
who said to me, just don't like take a job covering, you know, high school intramural sports somewhere.
If you want to do politics.
Well, I knew I wanted to, you know, definitely go to the South. He said, go work on a campaign. You'll learn a tremendous amount. And so that's why
What did you learn from dealing with reporters on the other end of the line? Because, you know, I don't think anyone's ever called you a flack before. But, like, what was it like? What were those reporters like back then? What kind of questions were you answering? And what did it really teach you about the process?
Well, I have to say, looking back on it, that I didn't get that many calls you know, from reporters who were doing real enterprise stories. I mean, they mainly seem happy in terms of their coverage of Henry Howell to come to press conferences and all write basically the same story. And we in the campaign tried very hard to get interest in some investigative topics because Howell, you know, saw an unvirtuous connection between the utilities, the big banks in Richmond, and campaign donations. But I don't remember getting a whole lot of reporters jazzed about
that. So it got you really, so you began to understand sort of the PAC mentality straight up.
A little bit.
Wow.
And it definitely made me not want to be part of the PAC. And, you know, after working inside the campaign, I then knew I wanted to get back mostly into journalism. I actually moved to Columbia, South Carolina and worked for an alternative weekly newspaper where I wrote about politics and I did extra writing jobs here and there and, in fact, did, you know, a little bit of campaign work because I was doing freelance writing for a firm that did both corporate clients and politicians, you know, progressive Democrats in Jimmy Carter's mold. And
that was a real moment in time. I want to actually get to the 76 when you were stringing for Time. Did you actually cover George Wallace?
I did.
Tell me a little
bit. And
I
actually covered his wife, Cornelia Wallace, because of the assassination attempt and Wallace being in a wheelchair, his wife, Cornelia, was scheduled, you know, every hour, you know, doing something physically active. And so I remember one of the Wallace-related events I covered was her going ice skating in some suburban area of Massachusetts. But you were interested, I think, in whether Henry Howell reminded me at all of Bernie Sanders. And in some ways, because he went against the tide so much at that time, there are certain, you know, certain people saw him as a gadfly, which is similar, but in terms of my quest to understand Southern politics, when I lived in South Carolina, I got to know a Democratic politician named Tom Turnipseed, who had actually been, you know, one of the top people in Wallace's presidential campaigns. And he had had a complete change of heart and had become a really super liberal Democrat. Kind of in Henry Howell's mold, but he was younger than that. And I called him recently to talk about this election. And, you know,
because you're doing these pieces for The Guardian.
Right. And he reminded me even more of Sanders. It was just my gut that if he was still politically active, he's in his, you know, late 70s, that he'd definitely be a Sanders man.
So if you were a kid now just coming out of Harvard, do you think you'd be inclined? Because the youth was talking to Joel Benenson recently about this, Hillary's top pollster and strategist, about this unbelievable youth gap, 7-1 in these states. If you were coming, and I asked him, I said, if you were, it was an interesting moment because I said, if Joel Benenson was 16 years old, Benenson worked for Bobby Kennedy.
Yeah, I mean, and I was in junior high school then and was a Bobby, you know, worshiper.
But if you were coming out, I mean, would you have, if you were just coming out of Harvard now, would you be a Sanders person, do you think? Or you, I mean, who would you go for as a...
You know, it's always hard to say and feel that you're completely in touch with yourself, given how long ago 1976 was. When I tell the students I now teach at Harvard that that's when I get out, they like can't believe it, and they come visit me in my office where I have a poster for Strange Justice, the book I wrote with Jane Mayer about Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. And they weren't even born
Amazing.
When that happened. They don't know what it was, some of them. So it was long ago. But I also, during college, was you know, very keen on the women's movement, and I belonged to a women's group called the Radcliffe Union of Students, and we would have these intense encounter sessions. So I think I would have been very excited by the idea of the first woman president, which was, of course, far from my thinking then. So, you know, I'm not sure. I think, you know, that Hillary Clinton would have, you know, appealed to me too.
That's a pretty interesting dynamic. In terms of, let's get back to 76 and Wallace. I'm fascinated by this. The one
let me just finish about Tom Turnipseed, which is, you know, when I called him, he said to me, "When I look in the mirror, I see Bernie Sanders." And all of the Sanders volunteers were working out of his law office.
How old is he now?
I think he's 78.
Wow.
This period in 1978 that we're talking about was when I became absolutely fascinated by the Republicans, because I did some coverage of Strom Thurmond, who was running for re-election. He had somewhat tough Democratic opposition, and you know, he was trying to prove that he wasn't too old, even back then, right, to be elected again. And he was traveling across the state, you know, with his wife, who was much younger and had won a beauty contest, and his little four adorable tow-headed children, because that's how he was going to fight that issue. And his campaign manager was Lee Atwater, who
was 12 at the time.
I became very friendly with him.
You became friendly?
I'm very friendly with him. And when, you know, my next job after that was in the election unit of NBC News, where I was a researcher, and Lee was, you know, one of my absolute best sources.
You liked him.
Because, you know, he was right inside the Reagan campaign.
How old was he at the time? He had to be like a little kid.
You know, he was a bit older than me, and I was a kid.
And was he was a fun person, right?
He was whip smart and one of those people who could quickly give you an overview of the full race, not just the spiel of, you know, either Thurmond or, you know, Reagan. So, and then, you know, when I moved to Washington and worked both at Legal Times, where I was the editor, and then for the Wall Street Journal and their Washington Bureau, we saw quite a bit of each other.
This progression of yours, which is, it's really interesting, and it's uncharacteristic, right? Particularly for somebody who rose to the level
right.
that you did at the Times. And I think it made you very, it's a much more diverse, interesting sort of background. I've had a journeyman's kind of career.
And right, I worked for a magazine, you know, Time Magazine was the first real job I had as a stringer, and then the year that I graduated from college and months afterwards, I worked in their Boston bureau. So a magazine, a crazy alternative weekly that doesn't exist anymore, then the election unit of NBC, because they were looking, you'll laugh, for a Southern expert, and I was able, you know, living in Columbia, to pose as that. But my education, you know, continued about the importance of the South, especially to the Republican Party. And, you know, when I lived in South Carolina, not only did I meet Atwater, but I met Harry Dent, who was the architect of Nixon's Southern strategy.
Which is now we've almost sort of run to the end of that string.
Right.
I mean, like, in terms of like what that party is about. So now as you
Election Unit, which was a TV network, and then I worked for many years for Steve Brill, who was founding a new magazine,
American Lawyer,
when I worked for him. And I met him when I was in the election unit, because he was doing a piece for the New York Times Magazine on John Connolly. And Connolly was one of my
the ultimate protean Southern politician.
So,
yeah.
So that's how.
So this was a period of real change in the business, real change in sort of Southern politics, real change in the Republican Party. a lot of roiling stuff going on. What was it like as a woman from the North, a Jewish woman from the North, a Jewish Ivy League educated woman from the North during that era going down and trying to cover these folks?
Well, the reaction of just about everybody, first when they heard this nasal voice, and then, you know, if they found out I had gone to Harvard, everybody would say to me in South Carolina, and really, you know, in Norfolk, Virginia, too, where Howell's campaign was headquartered, what are you doing here? I mean, seriously, it just was mind-boggling to them why this Jewish woman who was a born New Yorker and had spent all of her life in the Northeast, what was I doing there? And what I was doing is getting my political education.
Was it exciting? It was, I mean, this wasn't the dark ages, but I mean, was there, did you feel, which of those various categories that you fell into were was more of an impediment? Being Jewish, being
it's
a woman?
It's hard to say. Hard to pick the winner there. And, you know, by the time I got to the New York Times, when, you know, I would occasionally appear on C-SPAN and be interviewed with Brian Lamb, he would always do a quick overview of your resume. So it would be Jill Abramson, born in New York, you know, went to Fieldston, which is a private school, you know, outside of Manhattan, went to Harvard, works at the New York Times. I, you know, I would sometimes like get hate calls.
Really?
Because I was the caricature of, you know, the Northern elite.
Well, but you also crossed the line and you,
right.
And you were doing actual work.
You know,
and I mean, and I had that when I was in Alabama, too. So
yeah, living in Washington, I lived in Arlington, Virginia. I would be forced to say, well, I'm a Girl Scout co-leader of my daughter's troop to show
just to prove
I
that
was
you were
a
not.
Real American. And, you know, I am a real American.
Me too. I'm glad to see it. I'm glad. I'd like to see your birth certificate. But let's talk about the campaign a little bit. This campaign a little bit. I think it's fascinating that Trump, it's not just fascinating. I think it's telling that Trump does so well in Alabama. That is sort of a place of refuge for him, having covered Alabama. It gave me an added dimension to my understanding of what he's about. Just in general, I guess, what do you think, you've written about this for The Guardian, what do you think of the coverage of Trump? I was thinking about this morning. Do you think the coverage of Trump has enabled him, or do you think reporters didn't know what to make of this phenomenon or just now catching up?
I think that it is that at first reporters couldn't quite believe, like last summer, that this was a serious candidacy. It was unimaginable that Donald Trump could be president. And, you know, it just, I remember when Huffington Post said they were going to cover him in the entertainment section of their site. And, you know, I don't think many of, you know, the legacy newspapers, which have historically led campaign reporting, that I think many of them didn't even have a full-time reporter assigned to Trump. And I think it just was unimaginable. And what I think it shows, I don't view myself as a press critic, and I don't think that the press has either, you know, made Donald Trump or, you know, ignored him. But, you know, I think that it's, you know, the criticisms of the press that it's become too much of the elite, I feel that there's some truth to that.
How so?
And because so many newsrooms are filled with, you know, Ivy Leaguers like me, but a younger version, who haven't, you know, had the time to go live in the South for a couple of years and meet people who are really different.
Right.
And, you know, what I think everyone overlooked is how transformative the apprentice years were in.
Is that what we're calling them in America now?
Connecting Donald Trump to people who see themselves as the real America, that they somehow connected to him, even though on that show he's sometimes wearing a tuxedo and he's, you know, a billionaire from New York.
Oh, but people are always aspirational on that stuff. Have you been to a...
And I think one of the lines that fell flat for Ted Cruz was when he tried to say Trump represents New York values.
No, he doesn't. He represents a lot of... He represents a certain slice of American values. Have you been to... Have you been to a Trump rally?
I have.
It is
not one that was at all violent.
No, no, but isn't it? I've been at a few. I was at one in Lowell, Massachusetts. It's just extraordinary.
Yeah, I wrote about that.
He can read. The man can read a room. He can take the temperature.
That was a huge crowd.
18,000.
And it was bitter cold.
Bitter cold. He's throwing, chucking protesters out in 6-degree temperature. The man can really read a room in a way that I haven't seen a politician do in a long time.
And do you remember when he threw the protesters out?
Yep.
The crowd chant, USA.
Yeah.
USA.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was with Maggie Haberman, my buddy, who is now over at the Times. And Maggie was sitting with me. We went in Mufti. We didn't sit in the press pen.
Because I didn't know with Hillary Clinton. I don't have a current press credential.
I can get
but
you
I
one.
Would always rather be seeing it
in the
with,
crowd,
you know, voters than
well. The people behind me in the crowd had just
with
been
with the
to
rest
a,
of the press.
The people behind me had just been to a Jerry Springer taping. So there was, I mean, there was a lot, and I think a lot of people misread. That's another way to misread Trump. That it's just infotainment, right? I think people are capable of being both entertained by the guy and voting for him at the same time. In terms of the and you can answer this or not at your discretion.
You were asking me about the coverage too, though, and you know, something telling is that, you know, I teach a journalism course at Harvard. It's a seminar, and you know, because the campaign is so fascinating, I moved up the segment I do on political profiles. And I had a really hard time finding, you know, pieces on Trump to select among. I mean, there was Evan Osnos's New Yorker piece, which I felt was really good. And then, you know, the series that the Post has been doing, which I think is excellent on those decision moments.
Absolutely.
And how the candidates make a decision. I finally, you know, decided Mark Fisher's story about how Trump decided to do The Apprentice would be the one.
Oh, really?
To
so
read.
That was the one that you thought
but
was sort
I had
of central.
To hand it out in, you know, paper copies because, you know, it took me quite a while to find anything I felt was...
Why do you think that is?
...really deep. I think it's because of the tardiness of taking him seriously and that at the point he became really serious, you were swept into, you know, which I don't have any real patience for, you know, coverage that's all horse race and tactical. And, you know, a lot of the reporters I know that are on... the campaign trail now, and some of whom have covered Trump are very frustrated because they can't get off the trail doing the minute by minute, you know,
I think there's,
filing to do those sort of in-depth stories that can take a couple weeks.
I think there's another dynamic at play too. The coin of the realm is Trump said, colon, quote. That's the coin of the realm. What everyone wants is to get a quote from Trump that's going to blow up the news cycle, right? So I think you find, particularly earlier on in the campaign, I'm not going to call people out by name, but you had reporters, I think, who were really kissing his tuchus and trying to get access because it was really monetizable.
Sells. Yeah,
so
sells.
Like, you could look at our top 10 stories on any given day, and I've said this before, 7 or 8 of them will be Trump-related. Don't you think, to a certain extent, the standard rules that we play by sometimes as political reporters in terms of, you know, balance, calibrating access versus whacking them, right, got knocked out of whack by Trump.
I guess I don't like that's the calculus because I think those are two extremes. But, you know, I do think everybody knows that Trump and what he says is, you know, going to be a selling point. And I find, you know, in terms of the rules changing, I don't think, you know, for the press as a whole, the rules have really changed. But it sort of bothers me that on television, he is allowed to, you know, do his interviews on the phone from wherever he is, because he could be, you know, I don't think he is, but his aides can be feeding him lines.
Why are the Sunday shows? Why do the Sunday shows let him do that?
Because he's a ratings.
No, but I'm asking that. I'm asking that with outrage and rhetorically.
Yeah, but okay, sorry.
No,
I didn't quite catch.
I'm sorry about that. I think print generally acquits itself better than TV, just generically, right? But I also think, like, basic cable, particularly CNN and MSNBC, the night Hillary was losing Michigan, for God's sakes, they had 10 minutes of his empty podium in Florida. I mean, people got to start showing some self-restraint here, you know? So who do you think is doing the best job covering Trump right now? It's a loaded question.
No, you know, nothing stands out. I mean, those two pieces I mentioned stand out for me, but...
What do you want to know? Like, if you were an assigning editor right now and you had a team of 3 or 4 people, what would you want to know? What stories would you assign?
I would want to know more about his growing up. I think the piece that the New York Times did about his relationship with his alcoholic brother was interesting. And in terms of his character and shaping, I suspect that that part of his life, and, you know, things have been written about his relationship with his father, but in an investigative way. I'd like to know, you know, I still don't feel like I know, how much money did he inherit? It seems to be a topic of disagreement, and I'd like that sorted out. And of course, because of my background as an investigative reporter, covering money and politics, I want, you know, more about, you know, his money and how it was made, since he's mainly self-financing.
Do you think your former paper is having a good cycle?
I would never, like, criticize my old paper, and it's the first thing I read for politics, you know, every single day. You know, I'm on First Draft. That's probably the first all politics thing that I read early in the morning. I think it's great. I think Carl Hulse, who runs that, is one of the best political minds there is. So, you know, I love a lot of the Times coverage, and I guess I'm just selfishly wanting, you know, more of everything. Because, you know, I think Trump, the phenomenon, has sort of overtaken who is Trump. It also amuses me that why on television is he always called Donald Trump? No one ever
Or Mr. Trump.
Well, mostly it's his full name. It's odd because people don't say Hillary Clinton.
They say Hillary.
They call,
well, I guess the Donald. So everything with him comes in twos, right?
Right.
Like wives.
But I loved, like, a series that we did at the Times when I was managing editor that was called The Long Run, where we looked actually at the turning points in the lives of the candidates, mm-hmm. and really went deep on that. It's a little similar to the Post series now on Decision Moments, but these were real shaping. These were like Richard Ben Kramer type moments. And, you know, I feel like I haven't had that with Trump. And, you know, some of the pieces I've thought are fantastic on him. Steve Brill did one of the first investigative pieces about Trump U, Trump University in Time magazine. But it's like timing is everything. And he hadn't yet become a serious enough candidate. And Time is a bit diminished as something that everybody reads and sees. So I don't think it got the attention it deserved.
Now, the other candidate, well, we have other candidates, but I mean, Hillary Clinton is somebody that you've had a long experience with. And I wrote a piece with Maggie, I guess, a couple of years ago, when we were sort of researching how Hillary dealt with the media, which was an extremely dysfunctional on and off again relationship. The Clintons have for years and years and years been very, very, very conscious of the times. And I think there has been a sense over the years
of the
New York Times. And we mentioned in that piece that they felt that under your regime that you were, I guess because you were very close to Girth, Jeff Girth, an investigative reporter who did a lot of the Whitewater stuff. But when I hear you sort of talk about Hillary now, I mean, what do you think of the level of scrutiny that she is getting with respect to other candidates? Their complaint, David Brock's complaint all the time, is that they get a level of scrutiny that other candidates aren't getting. Do you think there's any justification to that, or do you think that's
I do.
You do?
Yeah, I do. She does get more scrutiny. And a former student of mine said to me, he's head of the Institute of Politics at Harvard. So he's real sharp. You know, he's head of the student part of it. And I asked him the same question, and he said something I hadn't even thought about, which is that we, for some reason, expect total purity from a woman candidate. He thought it was part of the sort of sexist double standard. And I just thought that was really interesting and possibly true, possibly one of the explanations for why.
I mean, she also has a lot of history, and she's been involved in a lot of other things that you're capable of scrutinizing more because they were in the public's sphere as opposed to Trump. I find business reporting in general, I think, strikes me as less rigorous than public sector reporting. But did you necessarily have that view when you were at the Times? Or is that something that's kind of come to you after you're gone about the scrutiny with her?
I did not feel during my regime that we were giving her, you know, way more scrutiny than anyone else. We were also raking over, you know, President Obama's record, and we went very deep on a couple of deals that he was involved in, you know, as a politician, that, you know, looked questionable, and, you know, certainly went to town on Bain and Romney. And I think all of this is justified. These people want to be president. They have to expect that every corner of their record is going to be looked at, where I think Hillary Clinton faces, you know, certainly more of a burden is that, you know, the controversies she's been in are immediately labeled, you know, Travelgate,
right,
or Emailgate,
right, right,
now, and that she has over time attracted, you know, she once made the mistake of calling it a vast right-wing conspiracy, but she, if you look up, if you search Hillary Clinton and liar or Hillary Clinton and dishonest, which I've done, it's like a total, you know,
tidal wave.
You know, it's a tidal,
yeah,
wave of Breitbart,
right,
and, you know, basically journalism that has a conservative.
Do you think? I mean, you have
base. So
commissioned a lot of work. You've done a lot of stories.
But certainly, that wasn't true of the time.
Well, no, but I mean, do you think that there is a? Do you think she's any more dishonest than any other politician?
I guess I'm still thinking that through, so I don't want to give you a reflexive answer. I'm thinking about writing about that really soon. But, you know, I think that all of these controversies, whether, you know, one of the profiles that I gave my students to read of her was one that was done when she was first lady in The New Yorker, written by Connie Brook. And, you know, it goes over Whitewater and Madison Guarantee. I picked it because it's the first article that ever suggested that she had presidential ambitions of her own.
I didn't realize
Bill
that.
Clinton,
wow.
Was president. But, you know, my students were pretty bored by that part of the profile. And, you know, the same student who, his name is Colin Deersing, who observed, you know, the purity issue, said to me, you know, Whitewater might as well be a brand of vodka to people his age. And basically all of these controversies have no real connection to, you know, real people or voters. Well, obviously over time, the issue of whether she's trustworthy has, you know, gathered, you know, a lot of steam, and that, you know, I certainly know that in recent polls that that is one of, you know, the negative issues that dogs her.
The emails.
Is whether you can trust her.
And the emails thing gives it shape and form, right? And your former paper, Michael Schmidt and other reporters there, Eric Lipton's done some really good work lately, have exposed that. I mean, when you sort of look, again, using your...
The problem is that, you know, you have to sort out, and I've called her, you know, taking the big speaking fees from Wall Street banks stupid.
Incredibly
but,
stupid.
You know, is it dishonest? And is her decision not to release her speeches there somehow, you know, dishonest or, you know, at least not transparent? I think that in some ways, you know, I've come to view these as real errors of judgment rather than a fundamental dishonesty or lack of trustworthiness.
Often born out of like a reflexive kind of paranoid
which
reaction.
She is justified in having. You know, going back to Little Rock days, you know, there were already, you know, journalists who were, you know, sort of prying into her marriage and those kinds of things. And
do you think the email thing is a big deal?
Not, I mean, so far, it depends on, you know, what your definition of big deal is, but I'm not going to play Bill Clinton for you here in our conversation. You know, I think that from the issue to me that's at the crux is that everything that we know that was classified after the fact,
right,
after the emails were sent. And so, you know, why is that a big deal? And the fact that she had this private, you know, email is something that, you know, I've read widely. A lot of people in the government.
Colin Powell being one that she mentions all the time.
Yeah, and Colin Powell, let's face it, got much bigger speaking fees than Hillary did. He was in these cavalcades of American heroes where, you know, they were being paid millions.
So
when you actually dissect these things, and moreover, when you ask either voters, as I have, or, you know, my students who, you know, read about Whitewater, if you actually ask people, like, what about any of these controversies bothers them, they don't know anything specific about any of them. I won't say nothing, but very little.
In terms of, you know, you obviously had your experience at the Times. There's been some reporting about kind of pay gaps and all that stuff in terms of the end there, and, you know, obviously there was the Nan Robertson book in the 70s, which is enormously influential.
I don't know if it's been enormously influential because there's still, you know, such a small number of women who are either the top editors or in the top ranks at many news organizations. So it's a great book. I have, you know, a special leather-bound edition of it.
I hope you got it signed.
I'm not sure it resulted, you know, in profound change anyway.
Well, in terms of your experience in the newsroom, and you rose, the thing I didn't realize when I was just kind of looking at your career is how quickly, I mean, you started the Times in 97, 98?
97.
I mean, that was a pretty fast...
I was an outsider,
that's
which
right.
is very unusual and may have in some ways, you know, it, you know, I feel it advantaged me as a journalist, but I'm not, I think at the beginning of my Times career, there were a lot of people who thought, who the hell is she? And et cetera, et cetera.
Do you think over time, and again, you know, this was, again, not the Stone Ages that you came there. You came there in 97. Did you feel that that culture that Nan Robertson described was still very much in place? And do you think it's still an issue for women over there?
You know, obviously not as much. I mean, she was talking about a world where, you know, women, including Mary McGrory, weren't allowed to be on the main floor of the press club. But they, you know, why it has its title,
right,
is they had to sit in the balcony. Although when that barrier fell, McGrory herself said that the food was better in the balcony. You know, the appearance of being all male and not at all diverse was, you know, not acceptable anymore. That's a big change. But sometimes I felt, you know, I was being included just because they needed a woman.
Well, we haven't had Bridget, my producer, you know, pointed this out to me a couple of weeks ago. We've had five or six. Well, of course, we're covering a presidential campaign. We're talking to a lot of candidates, so there are not a lot of women to talk to. But we haven't had a woman in six or seven podcasts. I mean,
I'm the woman.
You are our token.
But you know, I think where you were going with your question is like the echoes that I see. Well, they're not really echoes from Nan Robertson's time, but when women began breaking through and getting promoted to top jobs, there is a double standard. And, you know, there have been many studies that, you know, as women rise to especially the top job, their likability quotient goes down. Many, many studies show that. And with men, it doesn't work that way.
Well,
the things that are criticized or seen as unlikable in women, you know, that assertiveness is, you know, too much aggression, et cetera, et cetera. You know, those are seen as leaderly qualities in men.
When you first took over, having read profiles, when you first took over there, you took steps to sort of ameliorate that, right?
To promote women,
yes. But also to push against that notion that sort of hard-edged notion, like you, well, I mean, I had heard that in the newsroom you would go out of your way, like, to talk about a Metro story that you particularly liked, or just, you watered the plants, as they say in newsrooms.
Yeah, I tried to, but I still think that personal characteristics, like what, trying to figure out was I in a good mood or a bad mood, you know, that they're, You talked about Clinton and the intensity of the scrutiny she gets. It was just, the attention to those kinds of things was just palpably more.
Was that something you, again, getting back into the newsroom, was that something you understood in terms of, because Hillary was a big character throughout your entire tenure there, was that something that you understood, or did it take have your endgame experience there to really understand that?
It took my endgame experience to really understand it, to give you an honest answer. You know, I try to be the authentic me, you know, warts and all.
There's no real Jill that we're not seeing?
No, I don't. No, I think you're getting full Jill right here. And that's the only way I know how to operate, though. I think, you know, I would, you know, if I had to do it all over again, I would, you know, maybe sandpaper off, you know, some of the habits that I had. You know, I feel like I'm talking too much on this podcast.
No.
But I would, you know, raise the amount of time I spent listening and not talking.
Well, I mean, isn't that okay? I keep doing these Hillary parallels with you, but look at her first political act as a candidate, Jill. It was a listening tour, right?
Right.
I mean, this notion that you're talking about likability curdling the higher you sort of climb is pretty resonant when you sort of look at her experience
Of course.
Do you think, I mean, so how, okay, from like a coverage perspective, how do you compensate for that? How do you sort of run an organization where you're scrutinizing, giving the level of scrutiny this woman has? And you could say right now, if you're just handicapping it, she's more likely than not at the moment to be president of the United States, I think.
Mm-hmm.
How do you calibrate giving her the scrutiny that she deserves while understanding that there is this built-in sexism that is leading people to have these negative impressions of her?
You should be conscious of it. If, you know, I was still the editor of a major news organization, you know, you recognize that that can be a trap and an unfair one to the person who's being covered. And you drill it into all the editors below you that you don't want to see stories that begin with what she's wearing or whether she shouted and, you know, all of those things.
My least favorite story of the 2008 cycle was the Washington Post style section story about her showing more cleavage.
Yeah, I mean, that was like fingernails on a blackboard to me, too. But I have to admit, I thought the Saturday Night Live skit about her different colored pantsuits, where you go layer by layer, and even her pajamas are a unicolor pantsuit, I thought that was hilarious.
It is funny. And she enjoys it, you know, herself.
But that's not news.
That is not news. A couple of other questions, I'll let you go. In terms of her candidacy in general, I mean, the other thing is, like, she seems to have a real problem connecting with younger women.
That I wrote about, too.
Tell me a little bit why you think that is and how she can ameliorate it.
The young people I interviewed, and I interviewed quite a few of them, and I interviewed, you know, Lena Dunham, who's a big supporter of her. She cuts against that voting trend that has been so apparent in just about every primary except some of the southern ones. You know, young people want to be excited. They want to feel the way I did about Bobby Kennedy when I was in junior high school. They want to fall in love and feel, and they feel because they're young, not only do they want to change the world, but that they can. And so, you know, Clinton represents, I think, her familiarity, like, is a negative with young people. You know, perhaps her age is too, but there's just something that stops them, even though they think she's qualified to be president and might, you know, make a really good president. There's something about, you know, feeling the burn that really excites them.
It's also simple. He's got a simpler message. I mean, the one commonality between him and Trump, apart from whatever policy commonalities there might be, like on trade and stuff, is the simplicity of their messages. She has a really complex listicle sort of stump speech. I think it's more compact now. I think, like, campaigning in front of African American communities has made it more compact and succinct. But I think he's got a really simple message too. I mean, like,
which she profoundly disagrees with.
Right.
In a way, her message now is America has always been great and we are great. And I know how to get things done to keep us great.
Yeah. And I mean,
that is her message now.
And the question is, I mean, will that resonate or will she just, it's going to be a really negative. I mean, my fear is it's just going to be the most negative general election we've
ever
seen.
Mud ball versus mud ball.
I'm sorry.
But I think when you were asking, you asked me also to address how can she cut against that and excite young people. I think, you know, if she is a Democratic nominee, that just the fear of either a Donald Trump or a Ted Cruz will be enough to excite
to motivate
young people. I do.
Have you spoken with her since you have left the Times? Have you had any interaction with her?
I have such a bad memory. I don't think so.
When was the last time you talked with her in person?
At a birthday party of a friend of mine some years ago. She, when I became managing it, no, she came to the time certainly during her presidential campaign. And, you know, it seemed to me that when she was saying certain things weren't getting enough coverage, that she would look at me and sometimes even say my name. And
like, this is your responsibility.
No, almost like, you know, I know you and I know that you know what I'm saying is true. That's how I took it. And, you know, I don't know her well, but I met her in 1978 because, you know, some of that freelance work I was doing involved doing some writing for Bill Clinton's first campaign.
That's right. You worked for a firm. That's right.
And so I met her there. And
what was your first impression?
My first impression was that she was incredibly smart. She sat in on all the big strategy meetings. She was perfectly cordial to me. She didn't strike me as being particularly thrilled that, you know, he was running. I think maybe, you know, his congressional campaign that he lost had left
a
little bit of a bitter
nightmare.
I don't know that, yeah. But she that's one thing I remember. She didn't seem
into it.
I mean, she was into it in terms of her smart thinking, but emotionally, she didn't seem bubbly.
Oh, that's fascinating. Wow.
And then when I became a legal reporter for all those years I worked at Steve Brill, she was a great source. And I have to say, any time in my career that I have approached her for her own expertise or because of her job, she's been beyond helpful.
Really?
So it is. And I wrote about this a long time ago, but I think when she feels that people are mainly reaching out to her because she's an appendage of Bill,
right,
that she bristles.
Have you ever thought about writing a book about her?
No, I haven't.
Why not?
I think Jeff Gerth and Don Van Atta, I think, wrote a great book. A lot of people have said it's such a negative book, but I just reread it, and it isn't. But it's a thorough book.
It came out at the same time the Carl Bernstein book came out, as I recall, right?
That's right.
And the first five chapters of the Bernstein book are excellent, too, about her kind of her childhood. And her father was really a difficult person, it seems. So you have known this woman in a direct way for
I don't want to exaggerate.
No, but I mean, like,
I think in a superficial.
You've been around.
You've had
interactions with her for a very, very long time.
Yeah, I've watched her and been interested in her. I think one of the most interesting things that I did in my class this year is I had my students look at the video of her at the famous Pink
press conference
during Whitewater, and then we watched her at the Benghazi hearings, and, you know, it's very different.
She's better.
I mean, she's, you know, confident and fierce.
She is better. I guess the last question is, I think it's really interesting that almost all of the daily, not just the embeds, but most of the reporters covering the Hillary campaign are women.
There have been many. I've been called for there are many stories in the
girls
works.
On the bus story.
Right.
Do you think, how do I put this? Do you think that is an emblem of progress or an emblem of PR?
Of PR?
Yes, of people assigning women to that campaign so that they can say they have a woman covering the campaign. I mean, do you think that is a real, authentic attempt to have women have a prominent role with a prominent candidate, or do you think to a certain extent?
I mean, in some ways it echoes, you know, when Jesse Jackson was running for president, many news organizations looked around their newsrooms and tried to assign a black reporter to cover him, even if they weren't, politics wasn't their first thing. I mean, it may be a canny move where various editors have decided maybe the rapport with Hillary Clinton will be stronger if you have a woman covering her. I mean, that's another possibility.
But it isn't working. She's not talking to anybody. I mean, she talks to some people.
I was very glad that she finally gave an interview to Ruby Kramer of BuzzFeed.
Why?
Because I think that Ruby, I admire her because it's very hard, I think, at BuzzFeed when you're, you know, one of the girls on the bus to break away and do enterprise reporting. And I liked her story on Hillary and Faith, which went deep.
Right.
And she obviously had come off of the campaign trail to research and write that. I helped pick Amy Chozick to, you know, begin covering Hillary Clinton as a beat, like long before she
was. And that was controversial. The Clinton people gave
you
crap about that.
You know, they thought it was part of, you know, over scrutiny and, you know, me having some. I mean, it is absurd. I think you can tell from now I've begun to write under my own name about politics, which I hadn't done in quite a while. I mean, it's absurd to say, you know, that Jill Abramson is against Hillary Clinton. I admire her and, you know, kept in mind, you know, wanted to make sure that there was balance in our coverage.
But let me ask you one thing, though. I mean, there is an ethos in all newsrooms to scrutinize a candidate really hard. Do you think there was an additional pressure put on you? And you mentioned this encounter with Hillary where she kind of looks at you in the edit board meeting. Do you think that there was a sense that, well, Jill Abramson better cover Hillary Clinton really rigorously or people will assume that you're giving her a break?
I never thought that thought. I didn't.
Do you think that, is there sort of a machismo in newsrooms about covering Hillary Clinton really hard? I find, without giving away too much of the story, in the places where I have been, I've just wrote a really positive TikTok about Hillary Clinton's trajectory from New Hampshire to Super Tuesday, how she sort of turned it around, how she sharpened her message. And I got a lot of negative feedback from people who usually like those kind of stories. There's a lot of nice backroom detail in it. It was a standard TikTok,
mm-hmm.
right? A lot of people gave me crap on
readers
that story.
Readers or colleagues?
Colleagues, because they thought the story was overly positive.
You're not writing for them. You're writing for readers.
No, no, but what I'm just saying, there's an environment out there that writing a positive Hillary Clinton story is not acceptable. I do think that there is a certain built-in, I think your editors, my editors occasionally will look at you if you write something that's a little too positive about Hillary Clinton and think.
Well, I think that I can only speak from my experience at the Times, and as, you know, the Times is still the North Star for me of coverage period and political coverage, that, you know, I think that the reporters are, you know, follow the Abe Rosenthal motto that you keep the paper straight. So you don't go one way or another. And, you know, if I was going to look at Maggie's coverage or Amy's coverage, you know, Amy has done some, you know, she scrutinized the Clinton Foundation, but she does, you know, if Hillary Clinton comes forth with an important policy statement, she covers that too. And Maggie as well, and all of their political reporters.
Well, with that, Jill Abramson, thanks for taking the time. I really enjoyed it.
I've had a blast. Thanks.